Please be seated.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you, Your Honour. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
We'll pick up where we left off, and that was at subparagraph Roman 5 of your policy 10A 2.3, and there was a discussion before the lunch break in relation to the wording that you have expressed for this policy and the intention that sits behind the wording, and you acknowledge that there was a difference between those two things. So in terms of the wording that you have on the page here, wouldn't we be better simply to delete that and replace it with what it is you precisely mean, which, as I understood it, was maintaining priorities amongst existing users?
Yes, and I guess in light of the earlier discussion today, it may be useful to include flow sharing in there as well. Yes. So I guess just turning back to paragraph 66 is where I guess attempted to express what was meant there, but it's probably by the by, given the fact that we've had the discussion as to the intent anyway.
Can I just clarify that? I understood your answer to either myself or Mr. Moore that what was intended was something not unlike the matter of discretion on the RDA rule for water permits, which is to manage the obstructive effect on other users, which is quite a different proposition to managing priorities.
Yeah, I might have misunderstood actually there.
Okay, so what is it that, what's your outcome here?
The outcome here is that that as best possible, priority is maintained through the recognition that if you have priority which is influencing the hydrology, that by providing water for other users, you are maintaining that hydrology. And I guess the most obvious example is if there's someone with high priority at the bottom of a catchment, then other water users are required to leave water in the river for them, and therefore the river benefits for that reach. Probably the most extreme example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it could actually be a valid example too, couldn't it, in Otago?
It could potentially be.
Okie dokie. So I've made a note of that, and priority influencing hydrology, as it happens, just dovetails with the conversation we've been having in chambers for the last 10 minutes about what this might all be about, and whether you need to pick it up in an objective as well, actually, to make to drive an outcome here. Yep. Anyway, I won't cut across your cross-examination. We're still really interested in where you're going.
All right. So in light of what you are seeking to achieve in your Roman 5, do you foresee any issues where there might be a conflict between what that subparagraph is seeking to achieve and some of the other outcomes that are expressed in subparagraph C?
Potentially, and I guess the intent of the drafting was that there was an overarching lens, which is that prioritisation of health and water, health and well-being of the water body.
Brings us back to our challenges with understanding that phrase without having undertaken the full values assessment.
Yes, and I guess reflecting on that, you mentioned consideration of that under 104.1b. And I guess my view is someone has to interpret it at this resource consent phase. And I guess my experience with lodging resource consents and having councils interpret the MPSFM at that 104 stage is quite uncertain often. So while I recognise that that's one option, the intention was to provide more context at this point, and therefore maybe assist both the consent applicant and decision maker in that regard. But yeah, acknowledge that there, for full implementation of the MPSFM, there is a process that needs to occur still.
Isn't the better outcome simply to have people getting six-year permits, not 15-year permits?
I think generally, yes. The issue is that we may not, and I personally don't understand where all potential exceptions might rise. Really what I'm trying to do is acknowledge that there is the potential for activities legitimately to seek a longer term consent.
So you're leaving the door ajar for activities that you don't understand?
Or haven't been identified. There's two specific activities that have been discussed at length, and I'm relatively comfortable with those, but yeah.
Isn't there a danger in that approach, though, in terms of unforeseen consequences as to which activities might seek to take advantage of that pathway?
Not a danger in the activities, but a danger that that potentially the thresholds don't only let through those that are the exception that we're attempting to target, and I acknowledge that. I think there's a danger that there may be activities that have very little effect, for example, that get caught up in this and could justifiably gain a consent for a longer duration, or at least have access to it and the ability to move through that pathway.
All right. We will move on to the second part of the policy. So you've recognised and you've set out in your evidence a need for a pathway for drinking water or hydroelectricity generation to be accommodated within the non-complying activity framework. I want to start first with the supply of drinking water, and I want to understand what your basis is for seeking to elevate that in terms of consent duration.
Really, that's tied back to the second order priority in the MPS objective, where drinking water is actually specifically provided as an example of the type of activity contemplated there.
So when you're thinking about providing a carve-out for drinking water, just so I've understood how your drafting works in the first instance, there's no cap on consent term that could be sought?
No, for the matters under two, there's an availability of up to 35 years. It's not capped.
So in terms of the 35-year permit, in terms of drinking water, should that extend to water being used for rural and stock purposes?
I've left it as drinking water, as it's defined in the National Planning Standards definition. I think stock drinking water it's not specifically spelled out as a second order priority, and may not meet the health needs of people criteria.
How about irrigation?
No.
Watering sports fields and parks?
No, that would sit more comfortably under C of the objective.
How about dairy shed washdown?
The same situation.
Commercial vehicle washing?
The same situation.
Water blasting?
As above.
Commercial laundries.
As above.
And manufacturing.
C. Under the C priority, third priority.
So you're not intending to capture those types of activities in terms of providing a pathway forward for drinking water?
Not in terms of including that specific drinking water definition, no.
Have you read the evidence that has been filed by the territorial authorities?
I have, yes.
And in that evidence, you will have read the planning evidence of Mr. Tews.
I have, yes.
And Mr. Tews, in his evidence, referred to a memorandum prepared by somebody by the name of Ms. East. You're stretching your recollection.
Yeah, you are actually, yes.
I wonder whether we might provide to you paragraph 49 of Mr. Tews' statement of evidence in chief.
We can, Sally.
Thank you.
Just bear with me whilst I dial that up.
Oh, that's a good question. Which volume? Sorry. Oh, here we go. Mr. Tews' evidence.
And which paragraph you were going to?
49.
I have the paragraph. It's quite a long one. Do you want me to read it?
I don't want you to know. You could perhaps cast your eyes over it and you'll see some familiar words and phrases from our discussion.
Yes.
And you'll see there that in reference to Ms. East's memo, Mr. Tu states, she states it is not financially or practically feasible to separate water supply solely for human consumption from water use for purposes that contribute to the social and economic well-being of a community in other ways. So do you understand it from having refreshed your memory in relation to Mr. Tews' evidence that takes for community supply cover a wide range of uses?
Community water supplies, perhaps. Drinking water supplies, as per the definition, not so much.
So when you think about drinking water supplies, when you read this paragraph, it becomes clear that drinking water supplies are not a separate matter. They are included within the community supply, aren't they?
Look, I'm not sure that that's the case in every case from reading that. I accept that it might be the case often or even more often than not. In terms of community supply and the matters that sit underneath it, my view is that it moves down the priority order and therefore doesn't, in my view, require the same recognition. There's a potential that community water supply may include drinking water and all the other matters that you've outlined.
So where those constituent uses can't be separated out from a community supply, an application to replace a community supply should not be granted for longer than 6 years?
On the basis of my drafting and my rationale in relation to the MPSFM, it's correct.
Are you aware of any situations where there is a take solely and exclusively for drinking water supplies?
I'm not sure, sorry.
So if it transpires that there are in fact no takes exclusively for that purpose, given the range of uses, then providing a pathway for such uses would be superfluous?
Likely, yes. If it's not confined to drinking water as defined, then...
Let's move on to hydroelectricity generation. So, like drinking water, you have provided a pathway for, and correct me if I'm wrong, a 35-year permit for hydroelectricity generation?
Correct.
And your reasoning for doing that is to give effect to the NPS for renewable electricity generation?
Correct.
And when you read that NPS, which I'm sure you have, you will have observed that it has a preamble?
Correct.
And in that preamble, it expressly and explicitly notes that the NPS is not to be used for matters relating to priority?
Correct, yeah, from memory, yes.
And allocation?
Yes, there is a discussion about allocation. I understand that there is some case law context around the application of that preamble. The deep details I don't have to hand, but that's right.
So when you think about priority, what do you understand the word priority to mean in that context?
It's probably in relation to assigning water to a user ahead of others, I guess.
So when you think about the effect of granting a 35-year permit for hydroelectricity use, isn't that doing precisely that which you've described as being priority, when the NPS explicitly says don't do that?
It probably depends on the context of an individual take in this regard, where it sits amongst the catchment, and I guess there is a bit of a tension in the documentation that where there's an express provision for renewable energy generation, and to take it out of the context of any water at all is problematic. We'd just be talking about infrastructure in a river with no water involved. And as I understand it, that surely wasn't the intention of having that express provision.
Now you've lost me halfway through there, I'm afraid. So coming back to priority. Do you accept that granting or elevating hydroelectricity generation into its own category, perhaps with drinking water here, is giving priority to that use compared to all other uses?
In this situation, it's giving priority to a longer-term duration rather than priority to water outright. It's giving an opportunity for that water to have a longer duration or the use of that water.
So it's given priority over other takes.
In terms of the length of time it can continue.
And once it's been allocated out, it can't be subsequently taken back by the council and allocated to somebody else. Can it?
No, but it would need to be. It would need to be considered in light of the other abstractions and permits on the water body.
What do you mean by that?
So while the pathway would allow hydroelectricity generation abstraction to have a longer duration, there would be other, it would need to factor in other takes existing, and then in any future consenting process, it would also need to do the same. So it gives a longer duration of take, but it doesn't give it absolute priority over over other existing permits.
Well, once the water has been allocated, it does give it absolute priority over other future uses.
Future, new future uses, or replacements.
Could it apply to each?
I think it would probably give priority to new. And there would be have to be, a consideration of the overall allocation under whatever new regime pops out, and whether and presumably that would include the take we're talking about, the hydro take. So it would provide some level, I suppose, of priority, not absolute priority, but some.
And it's also, in that context, then providing an allocation to that use?
Through that resource consent, yes.
And again, that's precisely what the NPS says, don't use it for this.
Yeah, look, I'd probably have to refresh my memory of the preamble.
Do we have a copy of that in the common model?
Yes. Tab 7 in volume 3. CB 815. Now, second to last paragraph.
I guess my only question would be whether whether the development of national guidance in the future includes the just thinking out loud there. Look, I mean, on the face of it, I agree. Now, there may be some context around it that I'm missing as per the discussion about the case around allocation and the tension between freshwater policy statement and this one.
So what is it that you understand the purpose of this NPS to be?
To recognise the importance of renewable energy generation in the context as it's provided, and recognise the potential challenges with certain elements, operational challenges, and the like, and to provide some context for subservient policy direction.
So when you think about Plan Change 7, as Mr. De Pelsmaker recommends it be amended to, it doesn't preclude deemed permits being renewed, albeit for a six-year period, for hydroelectricity generation?
No, it doesn't.
And so Plan Change 7 is providing for that use?
To an extent. I guess my question is whether it is doing it to, whether a six-year duration is providing for that use in line with the policy direction anticipated, recognising the challenges of operational constraints, challenges, consenting challenges and the like.
But in light of the passage in the preamble you've just read, this document's not about elevating the status of hydroelectricity above other uses and giving it priority when it comes to consent duration, is it?
As discussed before, on the face of it.
And having made your recommendations in relation to hydroelectricity and the potential for a 35-year permit, I just want to test with you my understanding of your drafting. And I want to take you to the last paragraph on your page 2. So this is policy 10A23. 2, subparagraph B, that the activity meets the requirements of policy 10A 2.3.1 A to C. Now, we traversed in some detail those provisions this morning. Is it your intention that in relation to the renewal of a hydroelectricity permit that has a minimum flow applied to it, that minimum flow would simply be rolled over and a 35-year permit would then issue?
The intention was that hydroelectricity generation activities that meet the requirements of that list would have access to a longer duration. So I think my answer, given this morning in relation to the minimum flows, also applies to this. The intention was that the activities would be addressed in a very similar way, but the main change would be duration, with the duration available.
So the applicant has to jump through the subset of NPSFM requirements that you have sought to capture in your subparagraph C?
Correct.
I would benefit. I think you started off doing a very stepped process through subparagraphs A through C, and the witnesses answered more broadly. If it was your intention to deal with A, deal with B, deal with C, I would find that of value.
Happy to step through that. So let's go back to subparagraph A. So 10, capital A, 2.3.
Yes.
And there was reference to any existing residual flow, minimum flow or take cessation condition included as a condition of consent. Now, my recollection from the discussion this morning is that subparagraph A applies conjunctively with subparagraph B. Now, we might have to step through it piece by piece. So let's look at an activity which simply has an existing residual flow condition, but no minimum flow or no take cessation condition. So in relation to an application for consent in those circumstances, paragraph A applies.
Yes.
And what about paragraph B?
No, that relates to minimum flows in Schedule 2A. So it doesn't apply, sorry.
It does not.
Unless there is one. Where a residual flow exists, an existing residual flow exists, the intention is that B doesn't apply. That applies only to where there is no minimum flow, but a minimum flow has been set through Schedule 2A. No minimum flow on the consent.
And likewise, paragraph C would not apply because a existing residual flow exists.
Yes, that's right. Yes.
Going back to A, so we've stepped through now the existing residual flow, and we dealt with what happens in relation to a minimum flow this morning. If we move on to take cessation condition, does subparagraph B apply in that context?
B, no.
Subparagraph C.
No, because of an existing one applies.
And so for a would-be consent applicant for hydroelectricity generation seeking a 35-year permit, if their permit that they are replacing has an existing residual flow, then it simply gets rolled over for 35 years.
That is potentially the case, yes.
Is that what you intended?
On reflection, it's problematic.
Yeah, because all council's trying to do is just figure out how you might operate these conditions. And
understood.
I wasn't quite sure whether why you are saying, for example, if there's an existing residual flow, okay, so A applies. But if there is a schedule, if there are minimum flows in Schedule 2A but had yet to be carried down on a resource consent, why wouldn't it be apply? I thought that's what you were getting at, and Council, Mr. Moore's nodding away thinking that's what you've, you know, so the proposition is you've got, and this might be totally hypothetical and absolutely there's no relationship to anything that's currently happening, but the proposition is if you've got a residual flow, A applies. If you're also in a catchment with to which Schedule 2A also applies, and there are minimum flows, would not under your B a minimum flow also apply? So you pick. You've already got tick for the residual.
Yes.
You pick up the minimum on the way through with the B. C wouldn't apply.
C wouldn't apply.
So I think all Mr. Moore is trying to do is trying to figure out how you saw it operating, and
yes.
It's not how it's meant to be operating. you really need to tell us now so we can understand where you'd like to go.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think you have described it quite eloquently there.
Oh.
Thank you.
Okay.
Yes. So where A applies, where there is an existing residual flow, minimum flow, or take cessation condition, this gets dragged through to the new consent. The minimum under B, the minimum flow, where there isn't one on a consent, but one exists within the catchment in terms of Schedule 2A.
It gets picked up.
That gets picked up. So if you don't have any
conflict between a minimum flow under A and B, what's intended then? So you've got a minimum flow on your existing, and then there's a different one in 2A.
Yes, there would need to be some level of priority given to one or the other, which that currently doesn't do.
So they're both, what did you intend?
The intention was to align with the Schedule 2A minimum flows in a catchment if they exist to have that consistency. Now, thinking about that in light of questioning earlier with the adequacy of the minimum flows, it may be that you end up with a with an adjustment to hydrology because of that shift that is detrimental rather than providing an improvement.
Mm. You'd have to know where you're going, though, wouldn't you, in your parent policy? Well, this is the parent policy. Ideally, your parent objective. Yeah,
that's right, a parent objective. I guess the intention would be that the most restrictive or most beneficial of the two would prevail.
So now we're
in terms of moving towards an outcome.
Okay, all right. That looks like an environmental plan. But I understand what you're saying. Can I just ask one question? It's all very well imposing minimum limits, or minimum flows. What if Schedule 2A also says there's a block, an allocation block, so minimum flow together with allocation block? What do you do there? Do you just ignore the block? And if you do, what are the consequences? And maybe you do ignore the block, but you need to tell us, because the, you know, one of the things that the court has to grapple with is whether flows and block operate in tandem. And there's, you know, conflicting evidence on that.
If there was a if there was a block in place as well,
which I think there is for every Schedule 2A minimum flow, is that not so?
My recollection was there was a column with an allocation block size.
Yeah. And actually, also for if you're looking at, I might be wrong. If you're looking at minimum. If you're not in Schedule 2A, there's policy for calculation of minimum flows and allocation under the minimum flow. Allocation relative to the minimum. I need to look it up. Yeah. Anyway, let's take the simplest proposition. In Schedule 2A, there's also allocation blocks or limits.
Mm-hmm.
Do they apply? And if they don't, whose evidence would you rely on to say they don't and should not?
I think there's a risk that if you don't include it in the block, that you end up with a priority conflict amongst the users, potentially, along with allocating water above and beyond the block. If the block's full, then it's a significant challenge to obviously add more water. There's an over-allocation issue.
If you don't include an allocation block or limit, which is also provided for in Schedule 2, what are the consequences? Have you thought about that in terms of framing up policy?
Sorry, if you don't include
it. Yeah, if the allocation block or limit is not also included at the same time as the minimum flow, what are the environmental outcomes and the significance of those? Have you thought about that in terms of the wording here?
I guess water is being managed only with a minimum flow in that catchment. It would essentially bring the... It would have the consequence of bringing the flows towards the minimum flow potentially more quickly.
And holding it there, I think, is the evidence.
And holding it there, so...
Fish and game, yeah.
Potentially.
Okay.
So, just to round out the Schedule 2A line of questioning, a permit granted to a hydroelectricity generator for 35 years, complying with the minimum flow in Schedule 2A, essentially blocks in place that framework for a 35-year period, doesn't it?
Yes, it would. Yes.
To move on to the controlled activity rule now, if I can take you to your page 4, subparagraph C. Starts with any other conditions on expiring permits to be replaced. Now you've left this condition in the controlled activity rule, but you expressed some reservations about its inclusion, both in your summary this morning and also in your supplementary evidence. And I just want to understand those a little bit further. My recollection was that you said that bringing down existing conditions might broaden the range of subjects that the council might then look into on a renewal. Have I recalled that correctly?
That was in relation to my... The drafting contained in my evidence in chief, yes. There was a risk that by removing the matters of control and leaving them as I had stated it, that it could be broadened out, yes.
Oh, I see. So you're content that the drafting Mr. De Pelsmaker's put forward doesn't result in that, or that his wording addresses your concern?
Yes, with the reference to the entry conditions, which have the which addresses irrigated from irrigated area and the sort of rates and volumes that covers the in my view the key matters where things might get broadened out, but does leave the door open to consider bespoke controls of, for example, on the use of water that may not be irrigation, for example.
So my question, you're content with the drafting addressing that concern?
I am, yep.
Now, looking at the next difference between your framework and the framework that Mr. De Pelsmaker recommends, he, of course, has a restricted discretionary activity rule, whereas your proposal does not have that rule. Do you understand why Mr. De Pelsmaker has a restricted discretionary activity rule?
Yes, I do. Yep, in relation to challenges with data in terms of understanding the water used as opposed to the paper allocation.
So in relation to your framework, where there's a data gap, the activity bounces into the non-complying role? Have I understood that correctly?
It does in terms of the provisions that I've outlined here. I haven't given the restricted discretionary activity rule and the matters around the method by which the existing use of water has been sort of calculated. It wasn't something that the Ministry of Environment had submitted on, and I hadn't given it a great deal of thought, but I recognise that in the absence of another mechanism for picking up those activities, then non-complying pathway would be the only pathway available.
So, in your opinion, is non-complying activity status appropriate in those circumstances?
No. If it's, and I haven't looked at it, as I said, in great detail, but if it's really just a lack of data for a justifiable reason, then non-complying status would seem unusually harsh.
And so you not having bought through Mr. De Pelsmaker's restricted discretionary activity is not because you don't see merit in it, it's just simply not something that the Ministry had either instructed you to turn your mind to or you had turned your mind to?
Correct.
Thank you. No further questions.
Ms. Lennon.
Thank you, Your Honour. Good afternoon, Mr. Ensor.
Good afternoon.
I'm wondering, please, if I could take you to paragraph 17 of your supplementary evidence. And I was wondering, please, if you could read aloud 17.2.
Including hydroelectricity generation as an exemption has the potential to result in increased environmental costs. These may come about through adverse environmental effects occurring for a longer duration and without the full benefit of controls that might be driven by a MPSC-FM compliant plan. However, I understand that none of the large hydroelectricity generation water takes require renewal during the expected life of PC7 and the thresholds, and that's the thresholds in my policy proposed, go some way to addressing these potential costs.
Thank you. So, from reading this paragraph, by implication, you say that only large hydroelectricity schemes have environmental effects. Do you accept that?
No, what I was saying is that none of the large hydroelectricity generation water takes require renewal, and so it is the other hydro generation related takes that would be likely to use this pathway, and that the policy and the thresholds provide some way of addressing those costs.
So you do accept that there are smaller hydroelectricity schemes?
I understand that there are water permits relating to not the main hydro scheme consents on the rivers subject to the plan change.
Would you accept that smaller hydroelectricity schemes can also have environmental effects?
I'd accept that.
You also discussed the exception you've provided for drinking water or takes for drinking water in your drafting with Mr. Moore. From reading your evidence, you haven't talked about any potential environmental effects of takes for drinking water, have you?
No, I don't think so.
So would you accept that there may also be environmental effects for takes for drinking water or, as you discussed with Mr. Moore, community supplies?
Yes, I accept there might be.
There is one other topic that I wanted to ask you about, and it's Te Mana o Te Wai. So if you could refer, please, to your paragraph 67 in your evidence in chief.
Sorry, which paragraph?
67. So here you have referred to the second order priority under the objective of the NPSFM, including water takes for drinking water. And you've also referred to hydroelectricity generation as a third order priority under the NPSFM. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And you have provided exceptions for these activities in your drafting. Is that correct?
Correct.
I'm curious to understand how it is appropriate to grant exemptions for activities that fall under the second and third order priorities when we have not yet got a planning framework that gives effect to the first order priority. Do you accept that we do not yet have a planning regime that achieves the first order priority of Te Mana o Te Wai, which is the health and well-being of the water body?
I accept that the process envisaged under Part 3 of the NPSFM hasn't occurred.
So I suggest to you that there is no basis for your suggested exceptions, because we don't yet have a planning regime that fully achieves the first order priority, which is the health and well-being of the water body.
I guess the challenge is that there are applications that are due for renewal, and we're... We need to address them in a way that gives effect to the NPSFM as far as reasonably practical at this point in time. I accept that the full implementation process hasn't occurred, but that the NPSFM gives us some guidance, not a great deal, on what to do with applications in the interim, and we're forced in some regards to take what we can from it. And hence the inclusion of the sort of first reference to the first order priority in my policy 10A23 to at least attempt to elevate that through these consent processes that are occurring in the interim.
I did hear a discussion with my friend Mr. Moore on the shortcomings of that approach, so I'll leave it there. Thank you. I have no further questions.
Thank you. Ms. Baker Galloway or Doc? I don't actually have the director down. Should the director be down? No? Okay.
It's going to change tack for a little bit and look at the objective of the plan change. Yes. And you've said in several places in your evidence that you consider the objective of the plan change is accurately reflected as being just procedural. It's a procedural objective. And hence you've recommended no changes to it. Is that correct?
I haven't recommended any changes to it. Minister of the Environment hadn't submitted on the objective, although yeah, I acknowledge that there are potentially some challenges with it being just procedural if used in a certain way.
And even just looking at the theme of your proposed changes to the policies and the rules, if I can sum those up, you're looking at ways to ensure that there's not just no further environmental degradation, but that in some instances there may be required to be environmental improvements.
Yes, ideally where they can be made without causing too much challenge for the future process.
So in that sense, it would be useful for the objective to reflect the environmental objective of the plan change so that those provisions have a parent place in the objective.
Yes, ideally, the tension is, of course, that the purpose of the plan change is to be interim and as agile and, well, as streamlined as possible. And by starting to bolster the objective and even the policies somewhat, we start to stray into the future water allocation plan process.
Now, you might not have had the opportunity to read Mr. Farrell's supplementary evidence that was filed yesterday. Have you had a chance to
No, I haven't,
that?
Sorry.
So, what I'm... And, Mum, we're having printer issues.
Oh.
So I've got the version that was lodged yesterday, but I have got the correct version that you wanted, which has got the full unamended provisions from Mr. De Pelsmaker's 14 March.
Oh, yeah.
But at the moment, all I can hand up is the yesterday version.
Sorry, the moment you can hand up is yesterday's version.
Which has our current set of changes, just not in the context of the full set of the Pelsmaker's provision. So, but I understand you have got Mr. De Pelsmaker's 14 March evidence up there.
The evidence, yes.
In the Schedule 1 changes, his Appendix 1.
I have Appendix 1.
Appendix 1, that's good. So just while we're cobbling things together, and what I'll do is I'll hand up to you... And also the next version that's coming is in colour. So I'm assuming everyone else has got this online. I haven't printed out 15 copies of the wrong version of Mr. Farrell's evidence. No one's yelling at me, that's good. Right.
So I'm looking at a version dated the 23rd. That's all. It's not the full, it's not the complete set. It's partially
not the complete set. I've got a couple more spare paper copies.
No. One copy.
One copy.
Will be enough. Your printer issues are issues at work, are they, or just not? You haven't got access to a printer?
Oh, it's just a few blocks away, and then the communications.
Yes, you're getting there. Yeah. Back, no, understood. Yeah. If you get caught short, it may be that the facilities manager here can print something for you. That's all.
Thank you, thank you, ma'am. So, in Mr. Farrell's appendix on page 6, he's marked up. A revised set of changes to the objective. Now, you might recall in Mr. Farrell's evidence in chief, he split out the objective into a much shorter objective and then left the rest of it as a policy. So that's why it looks shorter.
Yes, I recall that.
Not the detail. I just want you to look at the first four lines at the moment, where he reflects that in this iteration of the objective that the environmental part of the objective is in the interim protect the health and well-being of water bodies from further adverse effects from water abstraction activities until a new land and water regional plan is made operative. So in terms of holding the line in the environmental sense, and given that a lot of your proposed changes to the remainder of Plan Change 7 have an environmental focus, what's your view on bringing that environmental focus up to the objective at a high level?
I guess on my just reading of it now, there's some similarities in the language used between Mr. Farrell's objective and one of the early parts of my policy. So without sort of considering in great detail, that familiarity probably suggests that it would be okay. It does apply obviously more widely across the rules, so it would also apply to the controlled activity rule, and I would have to sort of consider maybe in a little more detail as to whether that causes challenges for that streamlined approach. But it, as applied to outcomes sought through a non-complying pathway, it seems appropriate on the face of it.
Okay. All right. Well, that's what I wanted to ask about that. Picking up on the whether or not there should be exceptions for renewable energy and drinking water, the proposed regional policy statement, the partially operative regional policy statement, do you agree that it gives effect to the national policy statement for renewable energy generation?
It certainly should.
Yes. But have you reviewed it in that context?
I have looked at the regional policy statement in terms of the direction it provides for renewable energy generation. I haven't done a detailed analysis of whether it's translating the NPS through in enough detail or not, but I do accept that there is policy in the RPS relating to very similar matters.
Yes. Well, let's have a look at that. So that's Common Bundle 562, I think, and the partially operative RPS.
Soon see.
So I want you to find objective 4.3, which is CB 562, or page 57.
Yes, I have that in front of me.
Got that. Sorry, page what? Page 57.
57 of the actual document, but CB.
Oh yeah, no, I've got it. Yep.
562. Mm-hmm. So first of all, the objective: infrastructure is managed and developed in a sustainable way. We just go through it bit by bit. That objective, to give effect to that objective, there's no requirement for an exemption for renewable energy or municipal water supplies, is there?
No, not overtly, no.
No. And then a policy 4.3.1, the emphasis is on recognition and provision for infrastructure by matters listed in A to E. And none of those require an exemption from Plan Change 7 in order to give effect to that policy?
There's no overt direction, but there is recognising and providing for infrastructure by protecting, for example, lifeline utilities, which could include drinking water. Protection being a reasonably strong test.
So if we were thinking about protecting either drinking water or power generation or even power distribution, well, we're not talking about distribution, power generation, Plan Change 7 protects it to the extent that any existing permits or consents would be rolled over for the next 6 years?
As a minimum, yes.
At the minimum. And then one would assume that when the land and water plan is in place, giving effect to whatever the next version of the RPS will be and the national direction, those infrastructure services will also be properly protected, won't they?
Assuming, yes, yep. to give effect to this.
Yes. And similarly, 4.3.2, just requires recognition of the significance of infrastructure, including REG and municipal infrastructure. So we don't need to explicitly recognise those activities in order for Plan Change 7 to be consistent with this policy, do we?
I guess unless the significance, one of the matters of significance around the infrastructure related to somehow to duration, but no, not specifically. It's not specifically spelled out, no.
And in policy 4.3.3, the functional need of infrastructure is provided for by at least allowing for the six-year rollover of existing consents and permits, isn't it?
Probably, you know, in terms of the functional need of this infrastructure, specific infrastructure, I wouldn't know all of the details of the functional need. It may be that that there is some element of the infrastructure that might require a longer duration. But look, I don't think that's probably for me to say in terms of the details of functional need.
Okay. And I just had one more question of clarification, just in terms of the your amendments to the non-complying policy generally, in the context of the exceptions for drinking water and hydro generation. Were you envisaging the granting of longer term, but no increase in abstraction?
That's what I was envisaging.
That's what you were trying
yes.
to encapsulate. Okay. Okay, thanks. Because that still wasn't quite clear to me. That's fine.
Yeah, in that context, it would be new water if there was an increase.
Yes,
as opposed to a replacement.
Well, that's a very good segue, because that's what I was just about to ask you about. In terms of new water, were you here for Mr. Page's questioning of Mr. De Pelsmaker?
No, sorry, I wasn't.
Okay. So if you could get the have the regional water plan in front of you and go to rule 12.1.4.6.
No, I think this is just the schedule, sorry. Sorry, could you just repeat the reference?
Yeah, 12.1.4.6. And just for the record, this comes from page 659 of the transcript, so not proposing to put the transcript to the witness.
Sorry, which page of the transcript?
659, it starts at.
So 12.1.4.6.
And I just want to have a chance to read that. I imagine Mr. Enzel does too.
Yes, okay, I'll let everyone have a read.
through that.
So that's that was put to Mr. Pelsmaker, and then when we look at in Plan Change 7, Policy 10.A.2.2. That is the policy, the Plan Change 7 policy, that would apply to applications under Rule 12.1.4.6.
Yes, based on the phrasing at the beginning of that policy.
Yes. Now, small question. First, in your Appendix B, track changes... You haven't picked up Mr. De Pelsmaker's track changes to that policy.
Possibly not.
Is there a reason for that, or just it wasn't? It was just again one of those matters that wasn't
it possibly
in the might minister's have
been
radar. Like,
yeah, that's correct.
Yep. Okay, that's fine. But what this drew to our attention. As Mr. Page was working through it with the Mr. De Pelsmaker, is that there's something that could be treated as a loophole where one abstractor has to apply under the non-complying framework because they're replacing an existing permit, so under the Plan Change 7 non-complying permit, and their neighbour, as Mr. Page put it, could apply for new water under Rule 12.1.4.6 and be assessed as a restricted discretionary activity and have an easier consenting pathway by implication. Had you taken that into account when you reviewed the effectiveness of Plan Change 7 in terms of achieving its objective?
No, I hadn't drawn that conclusion.
Sorry, can you state your answer again? Council's question is whether you took that into account, and I thought your answer was, no, I didn't draw that conclusion. So then the complete answer is yes, I did, but I didn't draw that conclusion.
No, I didn't, and therefore I hadn't drawn
that conclusion.
What Mr. Farrell's evidence brings through now into the marked-up version, and I can assure you that this was pled in the submission as relief, so there is scope for it, it's right in the middle of the relief table, is a new non-complying rule, 10.A.3.2, that would make those new takes for water non-complying also, if they were for no more than 6 years. So rather than being considered as a restricted discretionary activity, they would be brought into that same non-complying group as any of the other longer duration applicants. Now, I know you haven't had time to consider Mr. Farrell's evidence in detail, but conceptually, do you agree that that is a more appropriate place for those applications for new water?
Yes, and it seems to align with the intent of Plan Change 7,
yep.
as I read it.
Okay. Thank you. And then finally, while you've got Mr. Farrell's supplementary... you'll be familiar that we've had this table with thresholds for minimum flows and allocation as a percentage of MELF.
Correct.
And that was initially proposed in response to the use of the words no more than minor in the non-complying policy itself. What is now proposed, if you look at Mr. Farrell's 10A24, so I'll let you just read that quietly.
I think I've gathered the gist.
I'll step through it. So the gist is that where there's a statutory requirement to assess that this no more than minor term, either in the context of notification or the non-complying gateway, that the minimum flow and allocation thresholds in the table be used as a signpost to require that the comprehensive hydrological and ecological assessments are required to demonstrate that effects meet the requisite threshold. Now, in terms of Plan Change 7 providing as much certainty to all users, do you see that the use of the presumptive minimum flow and allocation table in that context as being of assistance?
I certainly think that if there's an opportunity for certainty, we should look at it. I don't have the evidence behind the detail. I guess my only reservation is a percentage of MELF is only looking at one thing. So it would depend on the rest of the context in which it was being looked at. It would be, for example, if there was a cultural reason to look at things more closely, but it wasn't picked up here, that may not lead to good outcomes. I acknowledge if there's some evidence to support some additional certainty, then that's helpful, but just needs to be treated with caution, I guess. The trigger that is being used.
Okay, thank you. No further questions, Mum.
All right. Coming up to the break, and Forest and Bird, shall we get you started, or do you want to take the break now for your questions?
Sure,
You want the break now?
Sure.
Yep. Sure. Yeah, okay, great. That's what we'll do then. All right.
All rise.